I'm going to ask you to begin by describing your own memories of September 11th, 2001, and what that day was like for you and for the Amherst College community and just for the nation more generally.
My memory is vivid and still shockingly easy to recall. I had an appointment that morning at 9. It was an hour long or something like that. So while the attacks were happening, I was not present to any of the media that would have presented them to me. And one thing I remember especially is that when I went into my appointment, I realized it was one of those beautiful days that you should always remember. It's almost so beautiful, so clear, the sky was completely blue. It's as though time should stand still at such a moment, you know, just to be this day. So I felt this enormous sense of well-being and contentment, and I remember looking forward to coming back outside. And I came to my car, and I turned on the radio, and caught the tail end of somebody saying what had happened. And I couldn't believe this. I thought this was a kind of joke news report. But I kept listening, and it became clear that it wasn't. At some point that day, I felt this incredible need to see it, because I couldn't quite believe it still. Anyone who's there remembers that you could, if you had a television on, you could not escape the constant replaying of the hitting of the two towers. My historical memory is not particularly reliable, but I think the plane that was headed towards the Pentagon happens in that same day, of course, but later. So there was this sense, as I remember it, going through the day that this could just keep going, this horror, and where were their limits? And there kept being reports of other things, and, you know, they took all the planes down from the sky except fighter planes, and so it had a feeling of a kind of unpredictable but potentially a set of attacks without end. And that was part of the trauma. I don't remember how people reacted that first day. I think there was a gathering of the whole student body in the chapel, but I have vague memories of that.
I think it was Lefrak Gymnasium.
Probably because it had to be big enough.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I did go to that meeting, and I remember students being very, very upset with one of the speakers, who was Barbara
Ehrenreich,
right, who immediately created a context which she believed this belonged in, and it was a context about things that we had done that in some ways brought it on, and that there were a number of students who were intensely hostile to this and open about it. I remember Professors Makala and Levin speaking and thinking, two very good friends of mine, and I love them both, that this was not the moment for any kind of academic explanation or description, which is what they both really did. And I can remember watching students' faces, and I hope this was not a projection, but the feeling that what was going on in that large meeting was simply fell so far short of what people wanted, needed. And I think that's partly what started me thinking about how does one take something as unprecedented as this in a college and help people productively struggle with even naming what they're going through and what they fear and what they think this all means.
And so at some point, you and Professor Martha Saxton decided to begin running a discussion group about 9/11 and about related topics that arose. I guess you just touched upon why you felt such a group was necessary. When and how did you go about setting up that group?
I thought it was that fall. Certainly that's when she and I began to talk about the need for such a group. We both had a horror of a kind of disciples group or Professor Saxon's students group or Professor O'Connell's students group. We thought that was, it wouldn't meet things we thought were important. That is, that people gather together who do not necessarily know each other, that there'd be certain ground rules, that there'd be the greatest openness possible, and that we not be the leaders of the group, though we would support the discussions, and if things got troubled in unproductive ways, we might try to help sort it out. I think each of us chose 3 to 5 students, and we said to each of those students, bring to this group someone you know, you think would be interested, and whom you feel comfortable with. Because we wanted each of the students to have a peer there that, that they knew at least enough to know that, that there was a kind of comfort level. We hoped that we would construct a group that was both different within itself, and yet each person had some kind of other person's security in the group. And it worked. It worked beautifully.
And what were your intentions for the discussions?
We wanted a setting where people could express uncertain feelings as well as feelings of uncertainty. That is, I'm not sure how to put words to what I'm feeling or thinking, or this event scares me, but I don't know why. We wanted to encourage people in that group to affirm, in the face of enormity, that inarticulateness may be inescapable. And that's partly what makes it an agony and partly what is difficult, but it's also what makes what you're going through true. Is that how do you get your hands or your mind or your feelings around such things? And so that was the first goal, that it would be a group in which people could speak searchingly, and that people could take the risk of saying things that might be unpopular or surprising or unappealing or any number of things, but that was part of the ground rules, that their voices were never to be raised, that people were not to take attitudes towards each other.
And were there any particular points raised or moments in the group's discussions or conflicts within the group that stick out in your mind?
Yes, absolutely. There were a couple of people there, both women as it happened, who had a settled liberal ideological understanding of the events of 9/11, which a couple of times, I don't remember that it was more than that, they tried to insist upon to the group that this was the right way to understand it or respond to what had happened. And Martha and I found ourselves there, and one of the few times where we actually intervened and said, no, this is just not acceptable. It's, what you're saying is too easy to say, and it's self-aggrandizing. It may be, in some sense, right, but it's not right as a dogma. It cannot be. We want people to keep their minds and their feelings as open as possible here. And that was hard because I suppose it's fair to say that if Martha and I had any sympathies ideologically, they were with those two. Tonally, and the taking of a kind of self-righteous attitude, we did not have sympathy with. But we thought it was far more important for us to be teachers in the ways we understand good teaching. That is, you open and you make us enable as much as you can people to go places they hadn't thought to go. And then was my student who had, to my surprise, taken up the invitation to join the group, who came from a working class family in Connecticut, Italian American, very quiet, very, very special kid, I think. And towards the end of the group, he spoke up and talked about how he could not go home to this working class, Italian American, extended family, and even tell them about this group, because the very idea that there would be a group in which people were encouraged to be uncertain about what had happened would be unacceptable. And then he described what position he was supposed to take, and that is a patriot believes that the people who did this must be punished, that there's no explanation or cause that the United States is responsible for their doing it, and that we had to use all of our military strength in as many ways as was necessary to respond. It was an especially moving moment, which he was, on one hand, really speaking to all of us about the country we lived in a way, though he would not have presumed to say that. That is, a country where people had many different understandings of these, and you couldn't simply sort of adopt one as the right one. That you had to listen to them all. And that the experience of being in this group for him had been mostly one of listening, and he'd heard that there was a range of ways to think about it. And that he was troubled deeply that he could not take that range home. It had not changed him in some simple political sense, but it had changed him in terms of his capacity to hear a lot. It was amazing. His modesty and his own uncertainty were among the most powerful things I've ever seen. It didn't make him less loyal to his family. I think the change that he felt was that could no longer be a reflexive patriot. That he was a patriot still, but now that was itself complicated by all of this. Is what did loyalty to this country mean? What did caring about the welfare of this country mean? He once said to me, you put question marks after everything, he said. And he said, and what makes that worse is it's not just question marks of a simple kind, but it means I can't reject what I thought I believed any more certainly than I can reject its alternatives. I think he really learned that with much of human affairs, and especially ones so complex as that event, you can't readily discover what's right.
In addition to that discussion group, for several years you also taught with Professor Lisa Henderson at UMass, is that right?
Correct.
A course called Media, Culture, and Citizenship since 9/11. So could you describe the development and curriculum of that course?
Yes. The course began sometime before 9/11, which obviously we retitled after 9/11. The purpose of the course from the very beginning was to create a course about contemporary culture and politics that would ask students to encounter as concretely as possible things that Lisa and I took to be major problems, not simply within the United States, but across national boundaries as well. And again, this was a course which was not meant to be didactic, ever, but it was a course which was meant to be controversial, always. It might have been the first incarnation of a course after 9/11, and after we retitled it, we had a month unit on torture. I confess, and some people would hear this as didactic, I can't bear what I call falsifying language. So the rhetoric of justification used especially by American officials, I ridiculed savagely.
Can you give some examples of that?
Well, yes. Rendition is not torture. That was one of the lines that Dick Cheney used when we were sending people, particular countries, especially in the Middle East, where it was well known that people in prisons were routinely tortured. Or waterboarding does not kill people. It's not really torture. Because, of course, part of the defense that Bush and Cheney mounted repeatedly was this is not torture. So I would describe in elaborate length what these tortures were, and I made them watch a film in which waterboarding was central. So I would go after that, but then, I hope, try it anyway, I wanted to step back and say, is there a place in your mind where torture, that is, name this for what it is, where torture might be justified as a way of protecting a nation or as revenge? You know, I gave them lots of different terms to use. And there were raging debates in the class about this, of course, because there were a number of people, certainly, in the class who thought that identifying people who might have crucial strategic knowledge which would save us from further attack, it was justified to do whatever was necessary to extract that information. I was able to do, using sources of course, probably a close to complete census of all the people we were holding as terrorists, and to review details of their cases. An old student of mine was one of the major defense lawyers in Guantanamo and wrote an important book about it as well, John Heifetz. So I used what John had done and a whole team of lawyers who worked with him, said to students, well, who are terrorists? And then giving them the census and going through it and helping them to see how tenuous were the charges against a substantial number, probably at least two-thirds. And I think that we initially thought to rename the course after 9/11 because we believed it was, and I still actually do believe this, that it was a significant divide in the history of our culture. And so significant that to teach the kind of course we were teaching without acknowledging that in the title was wrong, and that therefore we had to also take it on explicitly in some fashion in the course.
For the past few years, it's just simply gone back to being called Media, Culture, and Global Citizenship.
Well, the sequence there is that 9/11 got taken out of the title of the course because in our reading, it was no longer in students' consciousness as large an event as we continue to believe it is. Every fall, you have to subtract or add 18 from the year you are in. And the reason you do that is it's important to remind yourself, especially if you teach the kind of materials I usually teach, How old your first year students were, your second year students, your third year, and so on, were when X happened? If you were up to 12 years old when 9/11 happened, its significance does not loom large in your consciousness. And we want to get students thinking hard about things that they either feel strongly about or can come to it very quickly. And 9/11 is past in the minds of undergraduates now.
Do you think 9/11 and the war on terror have contributed to any generational differences between the students you taught more than a decade ago and the students that you teach today?
Yes, I do think it has contributed. I don't think many students, many undergraduates right now, are very dependably self-conscious about that change. And it may be wrong to associate it entirely to 9/11, though I do. Students today, again, whether it's explicit in their heads or not, does not matter, they see themselves as living in a world in which their country is in decline. That would have been impossible before 9/11, frankly. It's not necessarily that 9/11 did it, but for Americans, for the first time in their history, really, to experience military vulnerability on a continental country, I don't know how you could ever measure the shock of that. And yes, then it was followed by other things that have further reinforced that sense. But certainly, at least here at Amherst, but also at UMass, students are very conscious of living in a world, an American world, of diminished possibility, whether we're talking about material things or vocational possibilities or jobs. They're very, very aware of that. And I think that was true before the recession. The recession is just sort of underlined. Such cultural things as this are extremely hard to get right, because what events and what perception of events can move through people's minds and influence how they act or fail to act are most often, I think, not tangible and visible to them. That's why if you pretend to be an expert in contemporary culture, you can only get in trouble, because if you're dealing with things that are not dependably tangible, that the people you're attributing them to are not self-conscious about, when you're living in a kind of surreal space. In a way, that's why I would argue nobody really dependably ever understands a cultural moment, because it involves large numbers of people and it involves the way people come to see or to resist seeing certain things. And it's very easy to be either self-righteous or arrogantly confident that you've got that. The way to put that is that I'm living in the same culture as my students. There are things that differentiate us, maybe nothing more significant than our age difference. But that doesn't put me in a position of authority any more than it puts them in a position of disauthority.
You mean in terms of understanding that culture?
Being able to articulate explicitly what you see, what you think is going on, how you're experiencing it, how it affects you, or how you see others. I think it's a very, very difficult thing to do. For a very long time, I've wanted to find a way to have discussions going on in the dorms, completely among students, but topics maybe assigned from outside. I used to have a fantasy when they were renovating the dorms about getting a closet built in each common room with holes in it so I could sit in the closet and listen without seeing. Not to violate their privacy, but so they would not be in any sense inhibited. So, for instance, if I said, well, I want you to talk about 9/11 and its impact on your lives, they might say, or come to a place where they say, well, we don't want to talk about this, and they end up talking about something else. Or they might just start talking about something else and never talk about 9/11. So it'd be fascinating to see how people construct reflection about things, as opposed to you're postulating what they might say. My closet metaphor may be too written with all sorts of significances, but it poses the problem when you make statements about a cultural moment.
Is that something that you have always believed and understood, or is it something that 9/11 has helped you to come to understand?
9/11 hasn't changed me that way. When I was in my first years of college, the person who became my mentor once said to me, God damn it, these were close to literally his words, will you get it through your head that there is no truth? And I looked at him, stunned at this, and I said something like, so why am I here? And he said, it is not the Catholic Church. It's, thank God, not St. Peter's Basilica, and I am not the Pope. And this was a truly traumatic event for me in my education, and it was a turning point. Eventually, I came, and he kept working with me, so he saw that he'd gotten through, to have a whole different concept of truth than I had grown up with, where truth was absolute and self-evident and delivered from on high. And it was that, as human beings, what the meaning of original sin is, to use the language of my faith, which I still believe, is that none of us have access to God. We see, as St. Augustine said, with partially darkened faculties. So that each of us carries in us, in some way or another, fragments of truths. And when we study human beings, that's what we discover. And because we are a fragment, we carry fragments too. You could argue that even the best work is fragments of fragments. And you could say, oh, well, why bother do it? Well, the reason to why bother do it is that we are, I think, or should be, always stretching towards understanding, and that to do that, we need to understand that we don't understand. I've arrived here, and I can say to you, well, Catherine, this is what 9/11 really means in my life, this is what 9/11 really means in others, this is what 9/11 means in the nation's life. It's absurd to talk that way. But if I say, I can be sure that this means something of great importance, whatever dimension I want to set it in, then I can keep searching, because I'm never likely to find a resting place that I think is sufficient.
Is there anything else that you'd like to add?
There's a way in which one might feel it's shocking that something like 9/11 could fade in people's consciousness. And I'm intrigued by that. I'm now at the age where I've had a lot of people I've loved die. Both my parents have died. I have a brother who's died. Several cousins have died. That one of the things that comforts me in their deaths is the memories I have of them. So right after someone's died, the fact that memory can be a comfort is not a comfort. Because at that moment, the acuteness of all the memories inscribe how much you've lost. And later, some time has passed in, the amount will differ by persons, it is a crucial consolation. So I take that as a kind of lesson about some other things. The fading away, or just even the fading, as with a bright t-shirt that gets, you know, paler and paler, but doesn't die, it's there. Part of that is a very intelligent human way of surviving. Because living with pain endlessly is truly unbearable and keeps you in the present moment insistently. At the same time, to stretch it out, if you forgot completely, you're at risk of wandering the world, not just naively, but helplessly. This is a real problem. How much and what should we struggle to remember of an historical event? And what is the cost of letting it go in what measure?